Hi, everyone. Welcome to Pedagogy Geeks, our podcast exploring topics supporting embodied musicianship. I'm Arielle Weiss.
And I'm Ryan Tusing. I'm a pianist and piano teacher based in Virginia.
And I'm an Alexander Technique teacher living here just outside of Philadelphia.
We invite you to join us in exploring the hows and whys behind what we teach musicians so that we can help promote the integration of wellness and musicianship.
We welcome your questions, and we hope to inspire your curiosity.
And to support and encourage re-examining, rediscovering, and bringing embodiment and creativity into our teaching.
We're excited to discuss today's topic, considering the student, the many facets of development. Ryan, I think this is right up your alley. I want to ask you about developmentally attuned teaching. Where does the idea come from? And why is it worth learning more about?
Well, Ariel, I would say to start with, it's a very big topic. And I mean big in this case as in multifaceted, as our title alludes to. Because, you know, a lot of times we hear the word development and we think immediately in the context of teaching of developmental psychology. Well, first of all, not to give too many spoilers, but that is definitely part of what we're thinking about. However, that is by no means exclusively what we're thinking about. We're thinking about musical development. We're thinking about, you know, as people learn skills, we're thinking about all of the different facets that we bring as human beings into learning anything. So that's what we're thinking about with that. The other thing that I would add is, the reason that this is important to think about is every person that comes in our studios, you know, brings different things with them. And so the more tools we have at our disposal in order to assess and to understand where they're coming from and whatnot, the better we will be able to help them. What are your thoughts, Arielle?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, I love to say one size does not fit all, right? So as educators, our job literally is to meet our students where they are. And in order to do that, we have to find them. We have to do some assessing. And so developmentally attuned teaching isn't just about where are they, you know, age-wise and what skills are developing. And I don't even think it's just where is their ability in developmentally speaking in the progress of what we're teaching them? I think it's ability and affinity, right? So if we start to think about learning styles or the pace of learning, one student might get an idea and run with it, and another student might need that idea several weeks or months or longer for that idea to stick. Or we might find that that idea isn't sticking and we need to come find what I call the back door, right? So all of those factors, right? Not just your age or, you know, maybe you're dealing with a student that is super short at the piano and you might have to, you know, change their bench or get them a riser so their feet meet the pedals, right? Or do they do better with imagination and giving them images, or do we need to stick to the facts and the science? So I'm thinking of so many factors. Are there any you think I'm leaving out, Ryan?
Well, I think you've really touched on a lot of them, which is wonderful. I would say the main things that I like to think about in addition to that are also just like the personality of the students. And, you know, to use the wonderful word that you brought out, affinity, to think about, like, even as far as teaching music, what kinds of music do they like? What sort of pieces and things are going to capture their interest, you know? And really, again, it's all of this stuff is connected to the way that people are learning. If we're thinking about their interest, we're thinking about the whole person, really. So I would say it's the topic can be no less broad in considering everything about them that they bring to the table when we're teaching them.
That's beautiful, Ryan. What are some of the ways that you assess a student when they come in to kind of figure out where they are that helps you meet them. Can you think of some questions or activities that you do that help assess those things?
Yeah, so first of all, I just like to have a conversation with them. And, depending on the age of the student, if it's an adult student, we'll just sit and talk. Or if it's a young student and their parent, we'll probably all be there together talking and just seeing what comes out. So I'd say a conversation is always a great place to start. But then what I'll often do is I'll often like show them, play a few pieces for them, get their feedback on those sorts of things. And then, I'll just, ask them about other things they're interested in and just noticing the way that they talk about things, noticing if they talk a lot or if they're just more like they're move they if it's a young student, if they're moving around a lot, like just seeing what kinds of things they're just already doing. So you can kind of get a sense of like, okay, maybe this is how they think. And then, maybe asking them, okay, what about this subject in school? Is it, what's your favorite? And finding out about those sorts of things. And then you can ask them some questions about that. And you start to be able to get a sense of how they learn about it because of the way that they're telling you about it. So again, it's interesting just to see how that works out. But I would say beyond that initial meeting, once you have, your first lesson with the student, you can really start to see it. And I would say basically my advice is this, get that initial sense in some conversations and then try some things and just start seeing what really resonates with them and what sticks and what things maybe don't seem to right away. That doesn't mean that those avenues of learning, you need to shut them down forever. It just might mean that right now it's not the best time to think about a particular thing.
Well, Ryan, first of all, I want to just applaud you because it's so beautiful what you just outlined. Clearly, the way you're beginning with a new student is to find them by establishing a relationship with them, finding out what they like, finding out a little bit about them before getting into the microcosm of teaching them about piano. And I just want to kind of point that out and highlight that. Because I know that's something that took me a while to figure out as a teacher, that I felt so beholden to the content that I kind of missed that first step. First, we establish a relationship. And when we have that trust, yes, everything's going to unfold with far more ease. So I just want to kind of go back to that very simple truth that was so apparent in what you shared. So with that being said, I find, especially with my music conservatory students who are in a very high pressure situation, that I kind of learned that my first meeting with my students at Curtis, I need to establish that my studio is quite different than their other music studios. Because in their other music studios, there's a very clear power dynamic and a very clear hierarchy. And so in my studio, I tell them it's the rules of the road that in my studio, it's a collaboration and that questions are always welcome. That if I say something that's not clear, please ask me and I'll try to say it another way. Right from the get-go, I'm trying to establish a very give and take relationship so that my student never feels that if they're not getting something, it's their fault. That the burden is always on me to come find them. And so I try to find ways to talk about that, like you, from the very first lesson. And then as we go along, like you, I'm trying to pay very close attention to did that imagery work or did it go, kind of in one ear and out the other? When I speak more scientifically and use anatomical language, do they perk up or do they start to fall asleep? Right. And always trying to use more than one approach when I introduce new content. So I'll usually offer the same content visually, auditorily, kinesthetically, tactily. I'll get as many sources in as I can. I'll also try to pay very good attention to the pacing of what I'm offering and also the amount of repetition. To me, those are key ingredients of that's going to determine the best way to meet a student. But I do want to kind of leave on that emphasis that I'm trying to get the student to help me make those determinations by asking them to help clue me in, by making that safe to tell me what their preferences are, which, again, depending on what kind of music teaching we're talking about, there may be some resistance or some blind spots there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, first of all, let me just say that was a beautiful answer, and you summed up so much, and I loved the way you were talking about it in terms of relationship and then sort of invitation in the sense of this, thinking about the power dynamic, thinking about just like, okay, I am here to help you and let's communicate and let's collaborate on this. I love that. And I love another thing that you said that just really sparked something for me was you're talking about how when you're working with a student, you're thinking about bringing in all the different avenues of learning and you're bringing them all in. You're not just, making a determination about the student, saying, okay, this student is primarily a visual learner. Therefore, I will only give them visual information. Which, to be honest with you, I think that is one of the things that can, happen in sometimes like when we're really thinking about the student, we can become too narrow because we can notice, oh, the student seems to do well with this. And so we only tend to give them one kind of information. So I think what you presented about, regardless of what we notice, the particularly strong areas are, though we'll certainly use those too, constantly, bringing in other means as well, because it can really enrich the student's, ability to learn well over time. So I love that.
I have a funny story to share, which having to do when I wasn't so open to using all the learning avenues. Many years ago, I had a student that was an IT guy. He was sitting at a computer writing code all day long. And so I made an assumption about this young man. And so I was carefully tailoring my lessons to be very scientific and factual. Yes. And then one day, my student starts talking about his meditation practice. And I went, oh, my IT guy that writes code all day, it has a spiritual meditation practice. And on that day, that lesson, I opened my narrow view of my student, and I started thinking much more imagistically, and I kind of started coloring with watercolor washes instead of finding pen. And that lesson was this huge light bulb opening moment for us both. I have never forgotten that moment, that the narrowness of my imagination was holding back my teaching and my students' learning because I had decided how we were going to meet. And so I think that's a cautionary tale, not just for me, in my very humbled way, is that, yeah, we don't always get it right, and that's okay. And so if we're willing to keep dipping our toe in another way, we might surprise ourselves. And, I don't care how exhaustively we interview our new student, we're never going to fully understand them as humans. And, we're quite three-dimensional as human beings. And so I encourage us all to leave the door open and always be willing to try something new. That was my very clear lesson that I carry with me.
Well, I love that. And I think, the whole idea of recognizing, even though it is our due diligence to get to know our students and to ask questions, to recognize that no person that we ever see, ourselves or anyone else, can be reduced to the answers to a set of questions. That is not it. People were always more than that. So recognizing that, and bringing that into our teaching, the way you've described is beautiful. Even if we notice initially that something is working, not to get, as a teacher, not to just get stuck there and think that that is the default way that we need to be teaching. And so for me, that's been really important. And I think that it reminded me that just because we're seeing something or we're getting a particular feedback from a student about something seeming to work or not work, that that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be trying to engage their imagination in other ways by bringing in these other avenues of learning. And so I'd say that was probably the main thing that comes to my mind about that.
You're sparking my curiosity here for a moment too, that because I feel like it's so important that it's not just us figuring it out, that it's just as important to kind of empower our students to speak up, right? To speak up and say, can you say that again, please? Or will you please show that to me again? Or I'm not quite understanding. There's so much shame, I think, in across the board educationally, if we don't get something right away. So how can we as educators foster a kind of safety and curiosity that makes it okay for someone to speak up, right? And I'm also just thinking about what the skill set is, right, for musicians, that musicians need to be able to follow direction. And if you're in an orchestral rehearsal, it may not be appropriate to ask a personalized question in that moment of the rehearsal. And so, how do we navigate those kind of skills that are needed to be able to take direction and follow direction, and also not just give up our agency in asking for the information we need, but finding a time appropriate and scene appropriate way to do that? So it's complex, isn't it? It's
Yes.
quite complex. Yeah, I'm thinking about, I teach senior citizens, and they need me to speak loudly and clearly and at a slower pace. And so when I forget and start prattling on, undoubtedly one of them will ask me to slow down. And my first response is always, thank you for telling me what you need. Yes, this was
Yes.
a golden rule when I was parenting a teen. I made it my rule that whenever my teen said anything to me, the first thing out of my mouth was, thank you for telling me. And so I feel that as educators, we can build that habit that when our students communicate with us, even if it's something that frustrates us or we're not feeling very patient about, or we think they shouldn't be where they are, or et cetera, that we always thank them for communicating with us. Now, that doesn't mean that I can't say, may I have a moment to finish my thought? Or can I get back to you in a moment? I'm still the teacher. I'm still guiding the lesson or the class or the workshop or the master class, but I don't want to shut someone down, right? I want to redirect them perhaps. Yeah. And a lot of times, I mean, can we name the elephant in the room? It's because you just said the thing they're asking about, right? Or you just demoed the thing that they're asking about. And inside, I'm thinking, I just said that. But for whatever reason, right, it didn't stick yet. So how do we show up for our student, right, to help it stick? So that could just mean repetition and not to be shamed about the need for repetition. It's how we learn everything. And it's not a race. These are my little quips, right? It's not a race. It's okay. Let's repeat it again. And the more I can support that patience in myself, then I'm really modeling that for my student, because that shame leads to not pretty things in music making, in my experience. Yes. And
Wow.
so that willingness to just open up to the process of learning, which is, we're really talking about perfectionism here, aren't we?
Yeah, that's so fascinating because so much of what you're saying is just really, you're saying it so beautifully, and you're just bringing out all of the different facets of it. I think when we chose the title that had to do with facets, I think there was something happening up beneath the surface that's really connecting, because you're highlighting all of these different elements of a thing, but you're just like, when it catches the light differently, we see another part of it that is so important. And I love what you're bringing out. And what I was hearing in part is this whole idea of teaching is bridge building, you know, to another person. Just the way you were talking about that is so important. And again, it really speaks to the, you know, the ongoing relational aspect of teaching and how that's, you know, we're talking to someone else, we're sharing with someone else, and it's a two-way, you know, conversation at best. And the other thing that really struck me when you were talking is this whole idea of, you know, often as teachers, we realize that, okay, I think I just said that thing that you're asking about, or I just demoed. But it made me think of a quote from a famous piano teacher of the past who was known for saying, "Teaching is not telling." And I am like, yes, because so often I feel like we can all, you know, in our very good attempts to help our students to like get something, we're kind of going down our mental checklist and we're thinking, okay, told them that, told them that, told them that, okay, we're good. But guess what? Nobody's good. Because unless they have understood and can apply and can understand and their curiosity has been piqued about whatever the thing is, words have just been uttered into the ether and they're floating around and they probably didn't hit your student's ear. You know, maybe just the sound waves, but that was all. So really this idea of really taking the time to recognize that just because we said or demonstrated something, it is not that that is not an indication that the student has it. And it doesn't mean that we didn't say it or demonstrate it in a good way. It just might mean that if we're paying attention to that student in a relational, attuned way to what they're doing, and we're seeing and noticing what they're doing, whether it's at an instrument or it's just, you know, however it is in the context, it's just recognizing that, wait, okay. Like you alluded to earlier, we need to find a back door. We need to find a side door. We need to find another way of, you know, of exploring this together. And guess what? That may not also be in the same lesson. It may be that you know, you need to come back to it in a couple lessons. But just keeping that idea, you know, that we're relating to the student and we're really trying to see and listen to them, you know, what the feedback they're giving us, you know, whether that's just spoken or it's what they're doing at the instrument, we need to really be engaging with that well to try to best understand them on a constant basis so we can, you know, share with them as best we can.
Ryan, it makes me want to retitle our episode to Relationally Attuned Teaching. That's
I
so
love
beautiful
that.
what you just said. Yeah. And it's I'm recalling a kind of famous quote which I cannot bring into my mind clearly, but it has to do with something like I can see something or I can hear something, right? I can believe something, right? But it's not until I experience something that it's mine. It's the experiential learning that really is going to stick. That's the secret sauce for something sticking. And so I actually have come up with a company policy. I'm going to use air quotes. My company policy, which I'm sure you've heard me say, is please don't believe me. I say this to all of my students, and it usually makes them laugh, which is good too. Right, because we learn better with a smile and with a giggle. But I explain quite directly that I want them not to disregard what I am showing them or telling them or demonstrating, but that if they use some constructive skepticism and go, oh, is that how that works? Is that what I do? How does that work? What happens if I do it this way? Then what I've got them doing is engaging in a process. And that leads to experiential learning. And I know that works better. So I explain that again right from the get-go, that their job is not to absorb, right? Their job is to meet and match and question and explore and experiment. And I don't think that's the way most of our students of any age learning anything are used to walking in a door. Right? We've been taught to be obedient and to consume and then spit it back out for a test, which does not serve us well if we're gonna want to make music or do something else. So more opening of doors and imagination about what that process is all about is necessary.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So all of those things being said, I'm really curious. I know you've had some experience teaching children like with mindful movement and various things. What things have you found from those experiences in teaching children? What particular considerations do you bring to the table when you're working with children?
Well, keep it simple. Keep it very, very simple. And as an Alexander teacher, when I have children come into my studio, it's because their parents think they need to be there. And for me, that can be a dicey situation. And so the first thing I really try to do is connect with that child and find out what they want. Right? And if they're not sure, then to kind of show them some of the ways about what I know might help them either usually feel better, right? Or it makes their sound better. So it's feel better or function better. Yes. And I find that's very important to change the orientation. So it's not because mom sent me, but to find something that the child wants. But I have one more kind of different track idea too, because I don't know if you know this about me, but I taught creative movement to very young children for about 25 years. And I used to teach 3 to 6 year olds, which a lot of people would not teach kids that young. And I absolutely loved it. I missed them terribly because 3 to 6 year olds will go anywhere with you. They have no guardrails on their imagination. They just go for it. And so I have another funny story, which is I did not study a lot of developmental psychology. And so I was not very aware of developmental stages of what kids should or shouldn't be able to do. In movement classes, it was very clear that, all of them could gallop, and then skipping was a real woohoo. When they get old enough to skip, it's very exciting. So I understood that. But here's a funny thing. Trisha Brown is a postmodern choreographer, very important in our very small world of postmodern dance history. And Trisha Brown did a very historic, iconic dance. That was, she would do some gestures and then she would do them in retrograde. She would do them backwards. And so I once taught 5 and 6 year olds about retrograde. And I would tell them, remember this word. I would teach them the word and say, go home, because at dinner, your parents will be very impressed if you talk about retrograde. And there's no way that a 5 and 6 year old should be able to understand retrograde. But I brought in a picture of a boomerang. And I explained that when you throw a boomerang, it comes back to you in space. And so we used that as a movement metaphor that they could imagine that. And then they found movement that they could do in one direction and then reverse it. It never should have been able to happen, and yet it did. And so I just want to say, for those of you that are experts in the field, I applaud you and appreciate your expertise, and don't close the door on possibility, because sometimes not knowing what's appropriate developmentally can actually lead to that was a magical day I will never forget, getting those little ones to make retrograde movement phrases. So I prattled on. I know you have a lot to say about this, Ryan. I'd
Well,
love
I
to hear.
love what you shared, and that story about, retrograde and the fact that, well, maybe they shouldn't have been able to do this, but it worked and it was fun. I think that is really probably the most important in my mind piece of the whole puzzle in talking about development is so much of it has to do with how we're engaging and how well we understand the information. And how we can, and the fun and curious ways that we can communicate it. And, again, without like this sort of like test mindset of like, okay, we're gonna do this and then we're gonna see, just how these people have got this. Not that kind of mindset at all, but just really that kind of curiosity and wanting to share something. I think that there's a great deal that can be said for that, regardless of who is in front of us, that sense of communication in that regard. And one thing that I have found is in teaching children, the one area that I have found that has sometimes been particularly tricky, or I would say it's not necessarily so much tricky, but it's really good to know about, especially if we're also used to teaching adults and older students too. It's to beware of abstraction when we're teaching very young children. Beware of abstraction. Because here's the other thing. If it's just abstraction, they're just going to glaze over. They're going to have no idea what you're talking about. And they're going to be like, I see a kitten over there. Or, oh, they're going to sit at the piano and start, whacking the keys or various things. And guess what? I think they should. They're giving us good information. Because guess what? Abstraction for very young children is not helpful. There are creative and concrete ways, as your story pictured so beautifully, that we can teach concepts like retrograde to them in ways that make sense to them. But guess what? The ways that you were talking about teaching to the retrograde to them were not abstract. They were concrete, they were embodied, they were, visual. Like you were showing it to them in all these different very real, tangible ways that they could remember. And I would say that is the essence of teaching children, or really anyone of any age, but specifically children here, is make it concrete, make it clear, make it embodied, make it imaginative, but don't, get lost in the world of ideas and dissertations and theories and all this stuff, because they're going to look at you like you're spewing nonsense, because that's the way it's going to read to them.
And make it fun. You
Yes.
just said it, and that's so important for children, but really for students of any age. We were playing Duck Duck Goose at my University of Delaware School of Music class a couple weeks ago, and I was teaching about inhibition, right? Which is a very scary word. But I put it in the context of this game, and it was a delight because my students had fun and they absolutely got to see through experiential learning what I was talking about. They put it into practice. And so I was appealing to their, funny bones, if you will, and it was really a great way in. But what you're saying is also reminding me of another facet that we haven't talked about, which comes up quite often for me when I'm teaching students at Curtis, which is students for whom English is not their first language. Or if you ever have an opportunity, I got to teach at a couple of training programs when I was visiting Japan a few years ago. And so that slowing down, right, for someone who is not a native English speaker, also, it's been an enormous eye-opening learning for me about how much jargon I use in my teaching. And so to really slow down and pay attention to what, idioms and jargons I'm using and, checking in, because a lot of times students will be embarrassed and won't want to tell you. They don't, right? You have to look for that glazed over look. Or just ask. Again, if I'm not embarrassed to ask, maybe that's modeling for you. You don't need to be embarrassed to ask, that we're all free to speak up here. But I find that we make a lot of assumptions as human beings. And I am a human being as a teacher. And so the more I can kind of uncover those habits of my own teaching, in how I use language, or the pace I go, or even the sequence that I choose, right? So if something is feeling stuck, one of the kind of guiding principles I would like to leave listeners with is check in with your student, ask some questions, and then look for another way in. Right? Always be willing to look. We might have, look, all of us have our favorite ways. And a lot of that is because they're tried and true. And then you're going to get one student it's not going to work with. And that student will teach us more, right? So when I start to understand when I'm feeling stuck with a student, instead of getting frustrated with them because they're not getting it, I go, oh, this is exciting. I'm going to learn something here because I'm going to have to get flexible and creative here.
That whole idea of, a flexible sense of posture with the way we're approaching our students and the way that we're thinking about things. And again, the whole sense of us taking responsibility for helping the students to learn. If they're working with us, and we're working with them, that sense of us realizing, okay, I'm supposed to be the person that's guiding them. I'm supposed to be the expert in the room, as it were. And I think when we really take ownership of that, it's a great invitation for us to really step back and clarify our own thinking and language and really think, how can we, shape the information in a way that it's as clear as possible and it's as simple as possible? Because I think, sometimes in music, speaking of jargon that you mentioned, musicians can be completely terrible about this. May I just confess that this is a problem we have? And so we can talk about all these very grandiose ideas about, oh, hypermeter and phrase length and, oh, the emphasis should be on the anacrusis and blah, blah, blah. And again, all of those things do mean something. I'm not saying they don't mean anything, but I'm saying a lot of times I think there might be clearer or simpler ways of showing or demonstrating the idea that even a very young child could understand, or that an adult amateur could understand that maybe hasn't had an opportunity for a lot of music experience, that we can communicate these same ideas, but in a way that drops some of the pretense and some of the, like, I don't know, like specific, like club membership kind of seeming ideas that go along with it. And again, it's not that necessarily when we use some of those terms that that's the implication, because it's not always the case. However, I think we have to be aware, of who we're speaking to, who we're working with, who we're teaching, because sometimes those connotations can come through even if we're not aware of it. So I think being aware of that is important.
You're teaching me something about my own teaching, right? Which I appreciate because I'm not a member of the club. I don't have years of musical training and I don't know the musical language all the time. And what I wanted to talk about and get us to next was this always leading our students back to their love of music. Like that fun factor is that when we start to like try to get something to get it right, and we lose the juiciness of because we want to make beautiful music because we love music, we detach in a way that's not going to help. And it's not going to get you there faster either, folks. I want to say that loud and proud. And so sometimes I tell my Curtis students, I'm just a human being with ears, right? I'm listening. I am a human being with ears, but they're not trained ears. But for instance, something like a big leap up in singing or on an instrument often requires what turns out to be an arduous moment of great tension. It's not needed, but that's often what happens when there's a big leap in pitch. And so I'll say like really simple things to my students, like, oh, why do you think the pitch goes up? Like, is it because it's in a moment of excitement? Because I'll get people to relate to how we use the speaking voice. Oh, right. If I raise my voice, it might be because I'm, curious or excited or happy, right? Or why might I get louder? Well, it might be because I'm upset or because I want to be emphatic, right? And I'll get them to speak conversationally and get them to think of it more holistically within the music about what that purposefulness is. What is the purpose? And when I get them to zoom out that way, then I'm tying them back into expressivity instead of perfect technique, right? So the technique is to support the expressivity. And so for me, that if you've got the cart before the horse and you're hammering away at your technique, it's probably not going to go better in my experience. And so that zooming out, linking it to fun, expressivity, the joy of the music, right? And then those everyday analogies, like we put our hands on things all day long, not just piano keys, right? So can we make those links, those bridges, another kind of bridge for our students, not between us and them, for them to the music, for them to their instrument, right? All of those, how that happens throughout their day as well.
I love that. And one thing that you're just bringing out for me that I have never really thought about in quite this way before is this whole idea that so much of what we are really doing when we're teaching well is we are getting rid of abstraction at all levels, not just with talking, teaching children, but we're trying to unveil abstraction. We're trying to bring it to a level of simplicity and clarity where we're connecting to those most important things, like the joy of our intention, and like, why do you love music? And bringing it to those things, and then thinking, okay, what is it concretely in that moment that we need to do? Being able to relate those things together, because again, they're not simplistic, but it's a series of simple things that may happen very close together or simultaneously, but really, not couching it in language that's very theoretical and abstract, really, I think, is so important. And it had never really occurred to me in quite this way because, as we were talking about before, I was thinking about when we teach children, of course, we're fairly aware of that. Okay, I need to be mindful of these things. But with adults, I don't think we think about that enough. And so I think this has really been helpful to me and just even reshaping my thinking. So thank you.
Well, it's actually inspiring me. I think we're going to need a whole episode about it because how we build information in a lesson, right, leads to that pacing and to that stick-to-itiveness that I was talking about earlier. And so we might call that scaffolding is the current term in educational theory. And I think we need an episode devoted to it. What do you think, Ryan?
I think that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah, because that how we build the information, what order, how much repetition, does that belong in today's lesson or should we address that next week? And it's something I know that for me, teaching university classes and courses has really helped me build a better understanding when I'm looking at the whole arc of a semester and deciding how I'm going to build information has absolutely helped the microcosm of my private lessons in how I think about building information. So I think that's kind of an interesting to be continued topic. What do you
I agree. I think it's a very interesting to be continued topic that we shall have to continue at another time.
Do you think there are any important disclaimers or guidelines that we should suggest for someone considering to begin to think about some of this information?
Well, it's interesting when, at the outset of the episode, as I was looking at our questions, thinking through things, I was really thinking, well, the biggest disclaimer that comes to mind is just really making sure that with all of these different ideas and theories and things, that we really actually consider the person in front of us and we don't just make generalizations. And I really think what's so beautiful about our conversation today is that doesn't even need to be a disclaimer at this point. It's so woven through our entire conversation that it's a real relational, interactive, collaborative, conversational element. That if we keep that in mind as we're considering every student that we will ever have the opportunity to work with, that I feel like that is probably the single most important thing to me. Yeah. What about you, Ariel? Any particular things that come up for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've said it, but to sum up, I would encourage all of us to take our time in a first lesson, getting to know the student in front of us. That now on the first day of an academic year at Curtis, I actually plan the first lesson is just getting to know them. I don't plan on any content, that it's just about intake and establishing a relationship. And for me, I had to plan that ahead, so that I would not rush myself, so that take your time. It's time well spent. And then again, to establish the rules of the road, right? That questions are welcome and speaking up. If I do something that doesn't feel right to you, please let me know that I'm going to ask your permission before I use touch, because I'm an Alexander Technique teacher. And I'm going to do my best to ask you each and every time. And if I forget, please remind me. Please let me know if that's not okay with you. I would say to learn to pause, to ask questions and check in our lessons, perhaps more than we are accustomed to. So I call them scenic vistas. So pausing to check in. How is that for you? Do you have a question? Does that make sense to you? So we can all learn to slow ourselves down and make more room, I think.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Any closing thoughts, Ryan? How do we bring this episode in for a landing?
This makes me think of a story. To the wonderful point that you've just made about, these scenic vistas and, interspersing questions throughout. That's something that with working with you and then also my piano teacher, Bob Durso, both of you are wonderful about that. And it's something that I've really found helpful myself. And I've really implemented that into my teaching over the last several years. And it's been interesting to me in teaching very young children. Like some students I've started, they're 5 or 4 or somewhere in that area. And then, some that are older, and I teach adult students too. But what I've noticed specifically is in some cases, like either with young children or just adults who've maybe had different music lessons before, I'll constantly, be, giving them opportunities to ask questions or various things, these pauses that you're speaking of. And what's interesting is sometimes I find people are just very eager. They're like, okay, yes, this is my feedback. And they're very interactive with you. And that's wonderful. And it's a great gift when that's the case. However, I've also found times when, students, they're really not quite sure. And so they might not have much to say. And you know what? I have had a couple students who they just haven't had a lot to say, with that sort of thing for a period of a couple of years. But I've continued to ask. I still ask. And what I have found, and this is just kind of interesting, like within the last couple of months, one of my students who that was just very much their experience, all of a sudden I started getting feedback. Like it was like all of a sudden they just started feeling comfortable, or their own sense of how they were thinking about it changed or shifted in some way. And so I've started to get all this feedback, and it's amazing just how that's opened up. So what I would encourage is for anyone, regardless of who they're teaching or how long they're doing it, really bringing in that practice of pausing and checking in, regularly, make it a practice, even if it takes a little while, or maybe you will never get a lot of response. The act of doing it is important, even if it doesn't, elicit, 5 paragraphs worth of intense detail of analysis. So I would just encourage the practice, to close.
Beautifully said. Well, thank you for joining us today and exploring how we think about teaching, learning, and performing. We'd love to hear your experiences and questions about how embodiment and mindset impacts your music making and your teaching. Send us your feedback and ideas for future Pedagogy Geeks episodes to pedagogygeeks@gmail.com.